This is The Bottom Line. I'm Doug Wells, and today we are speaking with Parker Conrad, founder and CEO of Zenefits. Parker's company is widely considered to be the fastest-growing SaaS company ever to come out of Silicon Valley. That's faster than Workday and even faster than the growth juggernaut, Salesforce.com. Amazingly, less than 3 years after its founding, Zenefits has raised more than $80 million at a rumored valuation of $500 million. Zenefits is disrupting the once sleepy business of small business HR solutions by giving away their cloud-based software for free. What's the catch? They're hoping these small businesses will choose to purchase their health insurance for employees through Zenefits. If they do, Zenefits makes a nice recurring commission, which is how the company makes most of their money. That all sounds great, except some incumbent insurance brokers are crying foul. Recently, four states, Texas, Wisconsin, Washington, and Utah, all considered barring Zenefits from operating in their state. All but Utah have retracted their complaints. As Parker Conrad and I chat today, the Utah legislature is debating House Bill 141, which, if passed, would open Utah's doors to Zenefits. Parker, thank you for joining us on The Bottom Line.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with Zenefits. When you describe Zenefits to potential customers or friends, how do you describe your company?
Basically what I say is, listen, if you're a business in the United States with less than 1,000 employees, one of the just really frustrating things about your situation is that you probably have about 20 different systems related to HR, things like payroll and medical insurance and 401ks and commuter benefits and time and attendance software and so on and so forth. And because those are all completely separate and disconnected systems, anytime you hire or terminate someone, you have to add or remove them in about 20 different places. And that means there's all this administrative work involved in running a business. In fact, for larger companies, there are entire departments or entire groups of people within HR that are just doing data entry and paperwork and systems administration and that sort of thing. And basically, if the world made any sense whatsoever, the way that this would all work is you'd have this one sort of central hub system where the company and its employees would go and make changes in this one place. And that system would sort of remote control all of the others and propagate changes out, sort of automatically manage all of this stuff for you. And that's essentially what Zenefits is, with this interesting wrinkle that because we make money on all of the spokes in this hub and spoke system, we give the hub away, this core system and all of the connective tissue, we give the hub away for free.
And, that makes a lot of sense. As a small business owner myself, we're in a non-coordinated system as well. And so it's really a pain. And I can see why you've had the traction that you have. HR software has been hot for the last 5 years. Why do you think there's so much interest in the track? Why now? Why is, companies like PeopleSoft, which has been around for a while, but newer players, Workday and Zen Payroll, why now? Why is this space getting all the attention now?
Gosh, I don't really know. I mean, to tell you the truth, I spend my day so heads down and focused on my business that, I don't have like tons of insight on the broader industry and landscape, to be totally honest. I know that, I came to this particular business as a business, small business owner myself. I started a company before this where, we could never afford to hire anyone in HR. And so myself and my co-founder dealt with all the stuff ourselves. And I just thought, this is such a pain. It's a couple of hours a month dealing with this stuff that I sort of deeply resented that I thought, there's got to be a better way to sort of connect all this up and do it all online. At least what I saw is that the state of technology in this industry, particularly on the insurance side, is stuck sort of about 30 years in the past. So that seemed like an area that was, pretty ripe for innovation.
Let me ask my question a different way. Could you have started Zenefits 7 years ago, or was there something that happened in the last 2 or 3 years that made it possible to create a company like yours?
If I had thought about starting this 7 years ago, I think I would have. you know, I wished I had. I'm not sure why.
You would have had the field to yourself, which is, yeah. It's kind of funny how that happens. You know, a field will go totally ignored, and then there'll be three startups all chasing the same space at the same time. Let me move on. I know our time is limited, and I want to circle back to Zenefits, but I do want to talk about your journey as an entrepreneur as well. So you have your undergrad from Harvard in chemistry. You joined Amgen, which is a big, successful biotech company down in Southern California. You were a product manager. You're a young graduate. You're living the life. You were with them for 3 years. And then one of your classmates called you up, Mike Shaw, and said, hey, I have an idea for a new company, basically a wiki for investors. And that was back in 2007. How did you think about leaving your comfortable day job and say, you know what, we're going to give it all up, we're going to move up to Silicon Valley, and we're going to work for nothing for a while and try to make this new company work?
Well, I think mostly... I had no idea what I was getting into, and so it was an incredibly ill-informed decision. Otherwise, I probably wouldn't have done it.
Naivete can be a wonderful thing, right?
Yeah, I think the ignorance was wonderful because, you know, you sort of had this vision of, you know, moving up to San Francisco and sort of collecting your millions and the sort of fame and success. And that it would, you know, maybe just be that easy. And, you know, unfortunately it wasn't. And part of the reason that I decided to sort of try and be an entrepreneur is that I, you know, I kind of looked around and I felt like I was doing well at Amgen, but when I sort of added up, you know, all of the different sort of rungs on the career ladder where you had to spend 2 years in this role and 2 years in this role, and there was this series of like tiny incremental steps that you needed to go through to move up, I sort of added up all the time there, and I was like, gosh, I'll be dead before I get anywhere in my career if I stay at this company. And so that was sort of a big impetus for me to sort of look around and see kind of what else I could do and what else was out there.
You know, and you talked about living the dream, right, the startup dream and the reality, and one of the things this show is about is sharing the reality. Your reality and most entrepreneurs' reality was quite a bit different. I had to laugh. When I heard about your move up, I read about your move up to Silicon Valley and your struggle to find a place to live. You guys were lucky. You and your roommate were lucky. The good news is you found a place to live for free for 6 months. But tell us what the bad news was. What was the situation there?
Yeah, so my co-founder's grandparents owned an apartment in a residential complex called Rossmore, which is about 45 minutes outside of San Francisco. And Rossmore is a retirement community, so you have to be over the age of 65 to live there. And so they had this apartment that they weren't using, so we were able to live there rent-free, which was great because we were broke. But the downside is we had to sneak in and out because we technically weren't allowed to be living there. And everyone else there was retired, and, you know, we were two, you know, 26-year-olds. And, you know, outside of this sort of residential community, there were only three stores. There was basically a Safeway, you know, basically a grocery store, a pharmacy store, and the store that was called literally a Better Denture.
It
was the worst 6 months of my life.
That's funny.
Deeply unpleasant.
We had a guest, Craig Earnshaw, who's a professor of entrepreneurship at BYU here in Utah recently. And one of the things he said is, when you're an entrepreneur, you have to learn to cheat. It's not right, but it's the reality. And so that's a perfect example of learning to cheat to make things work. So you guys started a company. It was initially called Wiki Invest. You and Mike were co-CEOs. And the company pivoted and is now known as Sigfig, which is in the investment, tracking, reporting business. It's now a fairly successful company. It tracks about $300 billion of assets, works with about 750,000 investors. So ultimately, it became successful. But what was the first year or two like there?
Well, I think, you know, for most of the time that I was at Sigfig, you know, we were always sort of a few months away from not being able to make payroll. We raised about $2.5 million early on, which at the time seemed like an incredible amount of money. But then, you know, we were sort of starting to run out of money in February of 2009 when we decided to go out and raise another round with a, you know, advertising-driven business model for a consumer-focused startup. And February of 2009 was probably the worst period of time in the world ever to try and raise money from venture capitalists, first of all. And second of all, the worst sort of business that you could walk in the door with was an advertising-driven business. And, you know, we went out and we probably met with 60 different firms, all of whom told us no. And then we spent, you know, the next 3 years trying to sort of keep the company alive and trying to sort of scrape together, you know, enough to kind of like keep it going.
And I want to come back to that because I know that that had an impact on how you decided to think about the revenue model for Zenefits. But before we go there, we talked before the interview about this show, and one of the things we like to do is share both the fun parts of entrepreneurship as well as the challenges. And one of the challenges, one of the factors you had to face was ultimately working at Sig Fig was not a match for you. Can you share with our audience how you ended up leaving Sig Fig and how you handled that experience?
Well, I don't know if it wasn't a match for me. I mean, I ultimately what happened is, you know, Mike and I started not getting along, and he fired me. And when that happened, I mean, honestly, I was devastated. You know, I'd built this company, been there for about 6 years, it was just a really hard time. And then, you know, after that happened, I agreed to sort of stick around for about a year to help finish off some work that I was responsible for and a few deals that I'd been negotiating. And so then not only was I fired, but then I spent a year sort of like still kind of at the company even after being fired, which, you know, was also just a terrible situation.
And if you were advising a friend that might be going through a situation like this in the future, if something like that happens, do you think in hindsight, would you have not stuck around for a year? Because I agree with you, that would be a very difficult situation.
Yeah, it's definitely not the right thing to do. But you've got to understand, I mean, the mindset at least that I was in was, I mean, this was my life. I thought the entire time I was there, you know, we were always sort of like 3 months away from missing payroll, but 6 months away from finding the thing that was going to like really make it big. And I believed that absolutely. And so, you know, when that happened, you know, I'd invested so much of myself into the company that, you know, I wanted to stick around. I wanted to stay around for, you know, as long as I possibly could.
And, I think a lot of entrepreneurs that find themselves in that situation, that's exactly it. It becomes their baby. They can't imagine leaving it. And so it is a really difficult thing. And I thank you for sharing that experience because you're obviously experiencing great success now. And, you know, the funny thing is in the entrepreneurial world, you know, we all say 80% of these companies fail. But we don't spend enough time talking to entrepreneurs about, hey, if it happens, you know, here's some ways to handle it. And I think people like yourself who are willing to talk about that experience makes it easier to have that conversation for all of us. So thank you for sharing that chapter in your life with
us. Well, the other thing is sometimes the failure is sort of glorified in a weird way. So, you know, people talk about like, oh, like, you know, it's a thing to be proud of or something that you take a lot away from, which I never found to be the case. I mean, I found like, you know, failure is an unequivocally bad thing. And I think that the only thing at least the only thing that I took away from failure and from my sort of 6 or so years at that company was that failure sucks so much and you never want it to happen again.
That is great advice.
You know, I'll do absolutely anything to avoid it happening. And that, you know, for the people who really have had big failures like that, that seems to be sort of a consistent thing that I've seen.
Let's take a quick break, and then we'll return to my conversation with Parker Conrad, founder and CEO of Zenefits. Welcome back to The Bottom Line on KCPW. I'm Doug Wells. Last week, I spoke with Parker Conrad, founder and CEO of Zenefits, one of the fastest-growing companies to ever come out of Silicon Valley. Now, rumor is the day you left Sig Fig was the day that you started Zenefits. I don't know if that's true or not. But if it is, how did that experience help you think about the business model for Zenefits? And after this, we'll move on to your current struggle with HB 141 or your current struggle with Utah and the current situation. But I want to start with the foundation of Zenefits. How did those experiences help you think about the business model for Zenefits?
Well, you know, the thing that I noticed at my last company was that, you know, we would meet with venture capitalists and you know, we met with all these firms over and over again over a period of time, over a period of several years. And when we meet with them, you know, the first time we meet with them, they say, well, you know, gosh, are you guys, is there a social component to this? Like maybe there are some network effects or something like that in this product. And they're like, that's not really what we do. It's an investment tool. And then 6 months later, they'd say, you know, what's your like Facebook application strategy? Because that was suddenly hot. And then, you know, 6 months later, it was like, are you guys going to build an iPhone app? You know, what are you doing with iPhone app? You know, an iPhone app. And, you know, maybe is there a gaming component to this? Is there some kind of game like structure you can do? And you're kind of like, geez, like what is up with these guys? And I sort of kind of decided that the sort of ADD of investors was so profound that, you know, their attention span was a lot shorter than, you know, the wavelength of their attention span was a lot shorter than the amount of time that it takes to build a really great business. And so when I started Zenefits, you know, I decided I wanted to try and build a company that wouldn't require me to raise money from investors, largely because I didn't think I was going to be able to. I was like, gosh, it's just too hard and too unpredictable to sort of be able to get capital. And so I started a business that I thought, like, maybe, you know, just maybe I'd be able to make it, you know, without very much capital at all. And it turns out that those are exactly the kinds of businesses that investors want to invest in. And so, it worked out really well. And, you know, we ended up being able to raise money on, you know, from really great investors and on sort of really attractive terms. And so suddenly, you know, it made sense to do that. And to grow the business more quickly.
And your model, the business model, I shared you're one of the fastest or probably the fastest growing SaaS, software as a service company in the history of Silicon Valley. In a recent interview, you shared that after 8 months, you hit $1 million in occurring annual revenues. In 2014, which was your first full year in operation, you hit $20 million in annual recurring revenues, and you're forecast to do $100 million this year. Your revenue model is really selling health insurance to the small business community, and that was your insight to create a model where you wouldn't need outside venture money. Is that correct?
You know, I'd say, I mean, health insurance is definitely most of our revenue, but it's not the way I think about it. The way I think about it is that there are a lot of these different systems that need to plug into a system of record for employees, whether it's time and attendance software, which we sell for about $8 per employee per month, or commuter benefits, which we make a bunch of money on, or 401ks that we make a bunch of money on, or health insurance, which, you know, happens to be particularly lucrative. That's kind of the way I think about it. And sort of the interesting thing was that, you know, there was a way to kind of give this core system away for free while still building sort of a really profitable business on top of it.
Right. And it's a brilliant business model. It's working. It's not without controversy, though. And anyway, so now I want to transition. Shortly after Thanksgiving of last year, Zenefits got a letter from the Utah's insurance commissioner, Todd Kaiser, in three other states that I mentioned in the open, Texas, Wisconsin, and Washington, were considering this issue as well. From the insurance standpoint, and had a complaint and said, hey, your business model is not consistent with the rules in our state. The other three states dropped their complaint, but Utah still has it ongoing. Explain to our audience what the complaint is and what you guys are doing to address that.
Basically, the complaint said that that our business model. So one of the things, Utah and several other states have laws where they say it's not legal for a broker to give any portion of their commission back to their clients. And so there was an argument that essentially the software that we give away was sort of a hidden rebate to our clients. There was some value, and we were providing that back to our clients. And you know, the issue is that there's no requirement that someone makes us their broker. They can come online and use us for, everything but the insurance if they want to, and manage that through some other system. What happens, though, is most companies, they want to do all of this in one place. And so it sort of happens very naturally that that many of them want to make us their broker. Commissioner Kaiser's argument was actually that, it's so easy to do your insurance through Zenefits that, everyone will want to do this, and therefore it's still unfair to other brokers in the state, even though there's no requirement that people do this.
Kind of ironic, right?
And
you
the
make
one
it
thing
easy.
I will say, what?
I was just going to say, it's kind of ironic if his argument is you make it too easy for people to use you as their broker. I mean, that's every broker's job, is to make it easy for customers to use them.
I'm quoting not quite word for word, but pretty much exactly what was said in the letter. So the one thing I will say, there are two things that we see here. One is in not just Utah, but in many, many, many states. We've been really successful to be growing quickly, and there are a lot of businesses that are convinced of the value that we provide for them and are becoming Zenefits customers. And what's happening is that, for a lot of sort of insurance brokers, that's painful. I hate it when we lose clients. It sort of wounds me every time. But the way that they are reacting is they're reaching out to state regulators and saying, hey, we need you guys to protect us from Zenefits, this new sort of online competitor that we don't have sort of a move against. And so we need you to do something from a regulatory perspective to block them. And in most states, in every state except for Utah so far, that hasn't really gone anywhere. In Utah, it did go somewhere initially, but I think to Utah's enormous credit. I had been just incredibly surprised and really impressed by the speed at which the state, and particularly the governor and the lieutenant governor and some of the other folks in the legislature, have moved to correct this. My feeling on this is Zenefits, I would like to say we're perfect, but the truth is, we make mistakes all the time as well. And I think the real measure of an institution is, how quickly you can fix them and acknowledge them when you do. And so I've just been incredibly impressed by that and incredibly hopeful with the passage of this bill in the House that we'll be back and working in the state in very short order.
Utah is a very pro-business state, and that was one of the ironies when I read first about the situation with your company that I saw was, here we're this pro-business state, but yet we're making it difficult for this business model that's legal in 49 other states to work here. But to Utah's credit, as you point out, they have responded. Your timing is pretty good because the legislative session is ongoing right now. I know that Representative John Notwell was a sponsor of HB House Bill 141. It passed the committee to be put onto a vote from the House with a 12-2 vote, which is a lot of support. I understand recently it passed the House, and so now it just has to pass the Senate. And as you say, the governor has also said, hey, this is a good thing. Let's get it through. Tell us, how does a business person, when you're faced with something like this, how did you get introduced to John Notwell, and how did he end up saying, this is a cause that I'm going to support?
The crazy thing is we weren't introduced to him. So what happened is we got this letter, and I thought, man, gosh, what are we going to do now? We're really screwed. Because, if you're a consumer company, if you're like an Uber or an Airbnb, you have this sort of enormous audience of people who really love your service and are using it all the time. But I was like, gosh, we make HR software. That's the most boring thing in the world. No one's going to care about that. But we sort of told folks about what was going on, and there was such an incredible outpouring of support, particularly from the tech community in Utah. Just really kind of rode to our aid and said, hey, this is not the way that we want to do business in this state. And so completely independent of us, I think Representative Notwell, heard about this, and I think, he's a sort of very libertarian pro-business guy, and said this, you know, this is not what we should be doing in the state, and introduced legislation to try and correct this. And of course, like, you know, since then I've had a chance to meet with him and speak with him. But at the time that he sort of put the bill in, you know, I hadn't yet.
That's a phenomenal story. I know your time's tight. I've got two last questions to wrap up on. You mentioned the entrepreneurial community here in Utah. A previous guest of this station and a friend of mine, Clint Betts, and some of his friends at Beehive Startups and iZenny put on an event called Start SLC last month. You were kind enough to fly out from the Bay Area and participate on that. How did you even find out about Start SLC, and how did you decide, hey, this is something I want to support? Because the Utah entrepreneurial ecosystem is really thriving, and an event like that was you know, really a bringing together the community, which was so powerful, and I was so glad to see you come out and support that.
Yeah, I mean, I found out about Beehive Startups largely through the this incident that we ran into. And, you know, I think Beehive Startups and Clint, you know, they were sort of instrumental in sort of spreading the word about what was going on and saying, you know, listen, this is important because, you know, if you're a tech company, you know, if you're a startup and you're trying to do something different, you know, every single one of those companies in Utah's tech community, if they are really successful, or as they become successful, they will start to run up against incumbents in one industry or another who are going to look around and say that, you know, hey, you know, this new market entrant is threatening to us and the way that we do things, and are going to start looking around for, you know, regulatory or legal ways to protect themselves from sort of, you know, new businesses. And I think, you know, everyone in that community sort of realized that this was not just about benefits. It was about sort of like what are the accepted norms of the ways that we're going to do things in Utah. And what does that mean for, you know, the future of this ecosystem?
Last question for you. So House Bill 141 is now being sent over to the Senate. Folks listening to this, how can people in Utah help the cause here?
Well, one thing is, is if you haven't signed our petition supporting this bill, please do so. If you go to zenefits.com/Utah, there's a change.org petition that, you know, you can sign and we'll help send it to, you know, some of the folks that will be key in kind of getting this bill passed and signed.
Yeah, and I should share with listeners, I signed the petition. In fact, that's how you ended up being a guest on the show. I sent you an email letting you know that I signed the petition. You were kind enough to say thanks for doing that, and I was able to cajole you into coming into the show. So, Parker, I'm glad I was able to do that. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Our guest this morning has been Parker Conrad, the founder and CEO of Zenefits. Today's show was recorded at the KCPW studios on Library Square and produced by Ross Chambliss. You can hear my entire interview with Parker Conrad on our website, kcpw.org. I'm Doug Wells. Join us next week on The Bottom Line.